Tony.
Hello, Canada. Today's date is April 28th, 2024. Welcome to a full edition of Canadian Common Sense, Canada's Issues, in about an hour. It is Tony in Saskatchewan.
And Lewis out here in BC, and I do know the date.
I had a late night last night, and I guess it shows. So we got a few housekeeping notes. I'll actually start it off by saying that because I was out late last night because Premier Scott Moe of Saskatchewan held the town hall meeting out in a small town about an hour outside of Saskatoon, but it's actually on the edge of his constituency. And with the provincial election coming up this fall, he's out making the rounds, of course. And this was not a Saskatchewan party event. So it was really interesting that he got a lot of questions that were, well, not typical questions you'd get at a party sanctioned event, because there was no fluff questions. There was no softballs that he was able to nail out of the park, as an example. He actually got roasted pretty hard by some of the folks in there, and I'll give him credit that he took it all with poise and grace. He was getting pretty agitated by the end of the whole thing, but yeah, there was no fluff and very few softballs for him. So I was kind of surprised. I'm really glad that I went.
Good. Yeah. But so what was he getting roasted about?
Mostly just about, like, there was a lot of seniors there, so he was getting roasted about affordability, and he didn't have a lot of answers. He was getting roasted about the healthcare system. Rural policing was a huge issue, and it is, I think, all across rural Canada, but in rural Saskatchewan, there's a lot of crime, and the RCMP are typically an hour and a half away. So there was a couple people who had just said, you know, well, we need to take care of this ourselves, but that makes us the criminals. And, you know, Scott Moe didn't have a lot of answers. He tended to deflect probably 80% of the time. He deflected and blamed Trudeau and just said, well, when we get a new federal government, we'll have a much more cooperative relationship. And so when my turn came up to ask, I just said, Mr. Moe, you continue to deflect to the federal government to blame for our problems. And if we have strong provinces, the federal government is essentially irrelevant when you take control of Section 92. And I listed off a few things because my question was about healthcare. And he still went right back to talking points and just deflecting, saying that, you know, we'll get a new federal government soon, and when that comes, we'll have a easier time with trade, with policing measures and stuff. And it was just like, no, we just said that you don't need that if you actually enforce the Constitution on them. But
yeah, well, I mean, the thing is that provinces in this country have a lot more power than they use. If you look at the province of Quebec, all Quebec does is use what's given to provinces and to the Constitution. Every province can do what Quebec does. But as we've seen, if, say, Alberta tries to get the same powers or tries to use the powers, the constitutional powers given to them, like Quebec does, they get called extremists and you know, all kinds of crazy names, just for trying to use what is constitutionally rightfully theirs. But Quebec does it, and Quebec is doing the best thing they can for their constituents or for their people.
Oh yeah, it's ridiculous. And there was a couple crackpots there. There was one big biker guy there who I think was probably quite drunk when he showed up. And when time came for question and answer, question was just wanting to tell Scott Moe that he's the best premier and thank you for being so great, and reminded him three or four times that he was the best premier ever, then just sort of waddled away from the mic. Good that he's got fans. But there was one fellow talking about chemtrails, and then and then the UN came up a couple of times, and I suppose fair enough, because there is a UNESCO heritage site within that riding that people had questions about. So That one was fair enough, but anytime someone brings up the UN, I mean the hair stands up in the back of my neck.
I mean, the UN is a corrupt organization, right? But
Yeah.
and an organization I think Canada should not even be part of anymore. But yeah, it's usually the people who bring that up at these political rallies or meetings or town halls that tend to also bring up chemtrails and bring up interdimensional child molester. It's like they're kind of crazy, right?
Yeah.
Usually. But I have seen people bring up the UN at these things and be completely reasonable people too. So
Yeah, there was a couple of those that were bringing up the UN in a reasonable fashion. One lady in particular, I remember, was actually had made quite a good case about it. But then there was another dude who was full crackpot on it too, and so just to talking about
Well, I
how
mean, if you want to bring up the UN and say how corrupt the organization is and how we should not be just accepting UNDRIP in our country without any kind of rational thought, and just adopting UNDRIP, which is the UN Declaration of Indigenous Rights, or UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Peoples. BC has just adopted it. I mean, no changes to it, no discussion. They just adopted it, and now you see them just giving land away in BC, talking about giving the indigenous veto powers over public land use and all this kind of stuff, and that's what happens when you just adopt an international organization's declaration without any kind of rational thought or criticism or
oh, yeah.
and I mean and if you want to talk about the UN in those terms, yeah, by all means. Because yeah, it's crazy what's happening in BC. I mean, everything that happens is crazy. So but I mean, and I just want to correct something I said last week. I was listening back to the show last week, like afterwards, and I do that every week. I always listen to the show again, just so I can see if there was any factual errors or anything like that, so that we could correct them the next week. And there was one, and I said 10% of BC's land was given away to the Haida Nation, and it should have been 1%. And as soon as I heard myself say 10%, I went, "Whoa, that's not right." So yeah, that was just I misspoke when I said that. It was 1% of BC's land mass, not 10%. But yeah, I mean, it's I just yeah, that's crazy. I mean, Scott Moe is a good premier. Don't get me wrong. He's one of the best in the country. But you can always be better.
And I mean, I give him full credit for standing up, because it was, I think he spoke for about 15, 20 minutes and then took questions for well over an hour. And
Good.
yeah, I mean, oftentimes they'll take 4 or 5 questions and walk out, but he stayed right until everybody was done. So I
Yeah, that's good. But I mean, you know what that says about him, right? Is that A, he cares, but B, is that he's not afraid to get questions because he knows how to answer them. He knows the answers. He might not give you the answer you're looking for, but he's not afraid to take questions, where you get like ministers in our federal government who don't even take questions, or they just rely on talking points that are on a sheet of paper in front of their face, and they just look down at it and read them off, right? I mean, the prime minister does that. So I mean, like that's you do have to give him credit for that. I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, most of his answers were I'll check that out, and I'll take a look at that. I didn't know about that or whatever, but fine. At least he was still there and did have some answers. Like for my healthcare question, for example, he had some answers, not the answers I was looking for, but at least we had the discussions. So.
Yeah, well, and it's you'd be surprised. I mean, not you, but the listeners would be surprised at how many topics or issues that elected government officials have no idea about. And so whenever they do a Q&A like this, there is a lot of things that are brought up that they don't even know about. Like I've met a couple of party leaders here in BC who had no idea about some of the issues that I was bringing up. They didn't know anything about them. And that's because this is, they deal on these big issues. They only talk about these big issues. Because that's what gets the public riled up. They don't focus on these little issues that actually matter. Like little issues that make it really difficult for small businesses to succeed.
Right.
They don't know anything about these things because nobody tells them about them.
Yeah, that's true. So speaking of that, let's get to our next housekeeping note. Someone who actually does seem to understand, Argentina President Javier Milei just delivered his first budget, and what do you know? The first balanced budget, or first budget surplus, I should say, in Argentina in 16 years. Guess he did trim some fat after all. Maybe that could be a lesson for eight of Canada's premiers and our prime minister, if you're listening.
Did their budget balance itself, or did they balance it?
Well, there you go. Therein lies the rub. Javier Milei did the work himself. He didn't just assume the balance budget would balance itself. So
Huh. Interesting.
yeah. So hopefully that's a sign of some leadership, which we lack in this country.
Yeah. I wonder if that, I wonder if that, idea could work here.
I wonder, yes.
Yeah.
So, another housekeeping note, listener Brett wrote in and just wanted to thank us for the laugh, I guess. He just said, yeah, after your show a couple of weeks ago when we were making fun of Justin Trudeau talking about $5 billion in housing investment on top of the $1 billion somewhere else, he says, yep, every time I hear million or billion now, I think of that and giggle and insert Dr. Evil. Well, you're welcome, Brett. Thank you. I actually do that too when I'm listening to the radio. And someone says that, and I'll say, no, you're saying it wrong. It's $1 billion investment.
Yeah.
Another housekeeping note, listener Bill had actually sent in a graphic that we had put up on our Facebook page when we were talking about BC and the fact that their population is so heavily centered in the lower mainland and southern tip of Vancouver Island in the case of BC. So he sent over a photo of Ontario and said, yeah, these little red marks here is where 75% of Ontarians live. And for those of you who are at least modestly familiar with Ontario, which is kind of me, I'm not really familiar with it, but it was essentially, it appeared to be kind of like the capital region around Ottawa, the GTA, the Golden Horseshoe area, and then a couple little spots down toward Windsor. So again, very, very urbanized. And so while it might not be quite as bad as BC in that, it's 1% of the landmass is controlling the whole province, and Ontario is probably 5% of the landmass. So
Yeah.
it's still pretty bad. So thanks for that, Bill. We did share that on our page. And I can't say this is a fact check, but let's just add in some more context for you. We talked about the ventilators last week, that the federal government had a surplus of ventilators and they were selling them off for scrap for $6 a pop. And well, actually, we'll talk about that one in a second. Just what they cost you and I, the taxpayer, though, was slightly more than $6. In fact, it was $22,000 each we paid for these ventilators that were being sold for $6. So what did we try to do when we heard that, Lewis?
Well, we decided to try and buy some. Now, where the $6 per ventilator came from was the sold price. So we were not able to buy any because it was an auction and someone bought them all for $6 each. And that's where the $6 each came from. That was not the asking price. That was what the auction finally sold for. So we were unable to get any because I had a plan, and that was to buy 20 of them and then give them as prizes to our listeners. And unfortunately, it did not work out.
Yeah, because that was a great idea. And I just kind of assumed they were for sale for $6, but nope, someone bought the whole lot. So
yeah,
womp womp. Okay, so this one came across the radar completely out of the blue, but we put up a piece on our Facebook page, and since not everybody's on Facebook, it was from Parks Canada, and Parks Canada admissions prices. So it said if you go to the Government of Canada website, you can even actually just do a quick Google search, Parks Canada fees. It brings you right to the page, and on there, without even discussing the fee structure, it will say free for youth, fantastic, free for newcomers to Canada, or free for new Canadians and newcomers to Canada. So I thought, okay, no fees for youth, newcomers to Canada, and new Canadians. So that means that if you're a citizen and you work, you pay. Well, that seems to be fair and balanced. Not.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the people who are actually born and raised here and pay all the taxes have to pay.
They have to pay. And then one of our listeners commented on that post and said, well, wait, isn't there a mental health exemption where you can get a doctor to prescribe for you a free pass from Parks Canada? And I thought, that sounds insane. So I looked it up and, well, thank you to that listener, because in the provinces of, drum roll, please, this is going to surprise nobody, BC and Saskatchewan, Manitoba and Ontario, you can go to your doctor and for mental health purposes, ask for a prescription for a Parks Canada pass for the season. And when they write you the prescription, you just got to go online and apply for that Parks pass. And I thought, wow, that's so.
I'm taking up the challenge, by the way.
And well, you should. Absolutely. Yeah.
Next time I go see my doctor in this wacky province, I'm going to ask for a prescription for a Parks Canada pass.
Yeah, I think you should, actually. I mean, we've only got one or two here in Saskatchewan, so it's not really anywhere close by me, but you've got more than that in BC, so I'd say go for it.
Yeah, I'm going to try. I'm going to find out just how easy it is to get this thing. So, yeah.
So yeah,
I'm going to do the hard work for our listeners.
So yep, stay tuned. So if you are a new Canadian, a newcomer, a youth, or someone who just needs a mental health break, you can get into Parks Canada for nothing.
Yep.
Wow. Oh, Canada. All right, so now we'll go across the country to Nova Scotia. Now, listener Kenny had sent a picture in, and this was from an account on X called Money Hugger Halifax, I believe it was called. And it actually fits right in with what you were talking about last week, Lewis, that you know, grocery stores are getting ready for people to be, you know, increase in shoplifting. Well, he sent a picture of this of a superstore in Halifax that was actually had put up plexiglass at the end of the checkout lines so that they're funneling people to only get out of the store one way because there is full floor-to-ceiling plexiglass preventing people from just, grab and go. And I thought, well, Lewis was right again.
Yeah, they're, I know that even like the superstore that's local here, the only way you can get out of the store now is if you go through the self-checkout. Like there's no way to get around the cashiers without going through the self-checkout now. So if you even have to use the washroom, You got to go through the self-checkout just to get to the washroom. So yeah, it's I'm gonna say that the shoplifting has probably already increased quite a bit at places like Superstore.
Yeah, well, I know I'd commented back to Kenny. There's a FreshCo in one of the poor neighborhoods here in Saskatoon that used to be a Safeway store, and it was already kind of designed that way just organically. The way it was set up is that you had to go through the cashier to get out, and then there was only one door at each end. So they have security there now, and you can't get out of the store without walking right by where the security guards are. So it's they're already set up, but yeah, now they have more security than they ever used to. So obviously the stores are preparing for it. Okay, last bit of housekeeping here. Alberta has well, they've talked about an early start to the wildfire season because of climate change, and you know how it's a little drier there because of climate change, and all they've had wildfires this year, and you know, because of climate change. Oh, wait. What is it? It says in 2024, almost all of Alberta's wildfires have been caused by what? Wait, human activity? What the hell does that mean?
Means it wasn't climate change.
What? Oh.
Unless your name happens to be climate change.
Oh, you mean like all those folks arrested last year for the forest fires in Quebec and Nova Scotia and Alberta and BC? And yeah, exactly. So, yes, human activity has caused all the wildfires in Alberta this year so far. So, don't let the narrative get in the way of a good story.
Yeah, well, it's like here in BC, like where we live in here in the Okanagan, it's one of the wettest springs that I've seen. I mean, it's been raining quite a bit, and it's been cooler than normal. I mean, we're still got. I mean, this is gonna sound pretty much like regular temperatures to you, but in BC, but in the Okanagan in BC here, this is really cool temperatures. Like we're still. There are mornings when I get up and it's like 2 or 3 degrees. And at this time of year, it shouldn't be that cold. It should be, 8 to 10, 10 to 12 degrees. But yeah, it's like 1 or 2 degrees outside some mornings. Like last week I came outside 3 mornings in a row. And I don't know why, but my neighbor was watering his lawn. I don't know why. It's too early for that, but and his lawn was completely covered in ice.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
Oh,
three mornings in a row.
jeez. So,
So.
yes, indeed. For the record, yes, that is the kind of temperatures we're having here. It's just barely above zero in the morning, and then in the, 10 to 12 low teens most days in the afternoon, sometimes up a little higher, but.
Yeah, well, that's what we're getting right now, and that's so. I mean, you can see how much cooler it is here than normal.
Right.
Because that's not the kind of temperatures that we get here at this time of year.
Yeah, exactly. So,
So yeah, so but hey, it's going to be hotter and drier than ever before, apparently. So
exactly. Yep.
yeah.
All right. So, we've got a good one for you today, Canada. On the show today, pushback in BC. Doctor, give us the news. Is Pierre Poilievre one of us? Traditional wives? EV plants in Ontario, hold your wallet, and more. Where do you want to start, sir?
Well, just for the sake of our listeners, I think we should start in wacky BC.
Of course we should. So now we're talking about drug decriminalization in BC. Oh, wait, we're always talking about that, but it's become more of an issue now because, well, we'll discuss that right away. If there's a city councilor in Surrey, which is right there in the Greater Vancouver area, who spoke up on a talk show earlier this week and just said, "Hey, this whole decriminalization thing has to change. We have neighborhoods in Surrey where we've never seen the vandalism, the petty theft, and people shooting up right in our residential streets. We have kids finding fentanyl patches and needles in playgrounds. There are people openly shooting up their drugs wherever they feel like it." And she's calling on the province of BC to do something about it. And that in itself is not news, but the fact that it's in Surrey, and the councillors are now starting to speak up, and we've heard mayors speaking up for a long time, so it's becoming a bit more of an issue, and she's not alone. What we'll say close up with Surrey is that Surrey is also home to an incredible amount of gang violence, and there's quite often shootouts between rival gangs in Surrey. So it's probably about time they spoke up about something.
Yeah, well, and I mean here in my little town of Summerland in BC here, we had one homeless person in our town who lives in his van and is kind of everybody in town knows who he is. He's a nice guy. He's kind of living in his van kind of by choice. Not really because of I mean he does have a substance abuse problem, but it's kind of
Like a hippie kind of thing.
yeah, more like this is kind of what he's chosen to do. He's refused jobs that were offered to him and stuff like that. So like he's kind of this is his choice. Last Saturday, four homeless people moved into our downtown city park right beside the playground and decided to live there. We've never had homeless people in this town because we don't have services for homeless people in this town. We don't have a soup kitchen. We don't have a homeless shelter. We don't have any of that because we didn't need it. And these people moved into our downtown city park, right beside the playground in the park, and started using drugs out in the open. And the police came by to ask them to move on. They refused, so the police left. There was nothing they could do. And so this has become an issue across the whole province. And this decriminalization experience was a colossal failure. We said it would be a colossal failure before it even happened. And it's been a bigger colossal failure than I think anybody could have even predicted. Like it's even the most pessimistic among us, which I am one of, could not have predicted the absolute mess that has become of this province in 1 year.
Yeah, and you've got
And
some support on that from the deputy chief of the Vancouver Police Department, as well as the deputy commissioner for the RCMP for BC, both testified at a House of Commons committee this past week that decriminalization, in their words, decriminalization has made BC worse off. The deputy commissioner of the RCMP testified that 50%, 50, half of all hydromorphone being seized in Hydromorphone, did I say that right? Yeah. Being seized in BC drug busts began as taxpayer-funded safe supply drugs. We said this was going to happen. And those among us who said, oh, no, it's all about harm reduction. No, it appears to be a bit more than just harm reduction.
yeah, and you remember the documentaries that Aaron
Oh.
Gunn put out, Vancouver is dying, and then later Canada is dying, pointed these facts out, and even said in the documentary that this is what's happening with the safe supply. The drug addicts are getting their safe supply from the government. They're selling it on the street so that they can buy fentanyl or harder drugs that they actually want, and then those drugs are being sold on the street. The safe supply is being sold on the street, and people called him a conspiracy theorist and said that he just hates drug addicts and is making stuff up, making facts up. And turns out, no, he was right. He was right, just like we were right. And, but I mean, I don't think that anybody could have predicted how bad the situation would get in 1 year. because like I predicted it was going to get bad, but I didn't predict it was going to get this bad. Like it's really bad here.
Yes, and
And
it's
I'm
a
sure
good.
it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad across the country, but in BC, it's the police can't do anything about it because it's legal here. Like in other provinces where it's happening, the police just refuse to do anything about it. Here, they can't do anything about it.
Yeah, so it's a good warning for places like, well, when Aaron Gunn's documentary Canada Is Dying, he did a pretty extensive dive into London, Ontario. And well, you guys want to see what's coming, London? Take a look at BC right now. But there's hope on the horizon because David Eby just this last week said, "Yeah, you know what? Maybe the government needs to do something about this decriminalization. That may have been a mistake." And well, Lewis, you and I are astute enough to know exactly why David Eby has now decided suddenly that decriminalization was a mistake. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the horrors on the streets or the open drug use in public. It has everything to do with Lewis.
Yeah, it has everything to do with the fact that a poll came out this week and for the first time shows the NDP in second place. The Conservatives are the Conservative BC Conservative Party is now in first with 39%. The NDP are down to 36%, and the BC United Soccer Team is at 15%. So now that there is polling showing that the people of BC are really, really unhappy. And now, with an election coming up this fall, the NDP are not going to win. They will lose in an election now. They decided, oh no, we got to do something about all this drug problem that everybody's been complaining about for friggin' 10 years. And David Eby has now asked the federal government to recriminalize public use, not recriminalize the drugs, just recriminalize public use of drugs. So he's not backtracking entirely. He's only partially backtracking. But, you know, I mean, the only reason they're doing this is because of that poll. Last week, they didn't care. Last week, they did not care that we were having the drug and homeless problem in this and overdose problem in this kind of province at all. They didn't care. But this week, now that there's a poll showing that they're losing, no, now suddenly they care. Now they're asking the federal government to recriminalize public use of drugs. And it's disgusting. If the polls weren't showing this, they would not have asked for this to happen.
Well, and it's good that you make that distinction that they only are asking to recriminalize the public use. So it's not the fact that they're not asking to recriminalize the drugs themselves. It's just yeah, make the problem go away so people don't see it anymore. That's really all they're asking. Just say they just don't want the public to see people doing these drugs in public. And that's disgusting. That's just that alone is disgusting. That it's only for their own political gain that they're even engaging in this conversation in the first place. And
Yeah.
that to me is the worst of politics. I understand it, but I
Yeah.
hate it.
No, so do I, because it has nothing to do with what the people in this province want. Has nothing to do with what's good for this province. It's just has to do with being able to be reelected. That's it. Like,
Yeah.
and to me, that's disgusting. And it's shameful. And it really just proves that how little they give a crap about the people in this province.
Well, that's true, but let's talk about the BC Conservatives. A year ago, 9 months ago for that matter, the BC Conservative Party was still just a footnote in BC political history until I think John Rustad was the first one to cross the floor. And even still after that, it took a few months before anybody even took notice of him. And suddenly, lightning in a bottle. I've never seen such a meteoric rise from a party that was really, yeah, really sitting in the waste bin of BC politics. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I mean even back what this time last year, I think it was, I said on this show that I didn't think that the BC Conservative Party would be any kind of force to be reckoned with. I didn't think that they would be, I figured that they would remain a third place party. And now they're first place party, the NDP are second, and the BC United Soccer team is way in third place and so low in the polls that they would not win a single seat if an election were held today.
Wow.
Now, and I said, because BC is a very left-wing province overall. But let's be honest here. This has very, very, very little to do with the BC Conservatives. This has very, very little to do with John Rustad. This has far more to do with Pierre Poilievre and the federal conservatives than it does with them. BC conservative support is skyrocketing simply because of the popularity of the federal conservative party. I'm not saying that this isn't going to be good for BC. It will be good for BC if they happen to win the election in the fall, because the NDP have done an absolutely wonderful job of messing this province up even more than it was. But this has very little to do with the BC Conservative Party or their leader, John Rustad, because I don't know anybody. I've talked to people and nobody even knows who the leader of the party is. But they're gonna vote for them. And so to me, that says this has very little to do with them and everything to do with Pierre Poilievre and the federal conservatives.
Okay, well, and let's talk about Pierre Poilievre and the Federal Conservatives, because boy, did he ever step on a landmine out on the East Coast. Well, okay, I'm saying that tongue in cheek. There was a carbon tax anti-carbon tax rally protest going on since April 1st, and it's still going over on the New Brunswick, Nova Scotia border. There's also still one on the Alberta, Saskatchewan border going on. And Pierre Poilievre was doing a rally in, I can't remember if it was in PEI, but anywhere, somewhere in the East Coast. As they're driving, they happen to see this protest just outside of whatever the town was in Nova Scotia along the border, and said, "Oh, well, I should probably stop in and say hello and show some support, etc." So he did, and oh my gosh, he dared to take a photo with somebody, and there was an F. Trudeau flag in the background. Well, if that wasn't the dumbest decision he ever made, there was another picture where he dared to walk out of the trailer, which was kind of the office of where the organizers were, and there was a very tiny little Diaghilon symbol near the bottom of the door. But of course, when someone got a hold of that, they made certain they blew that up and circled, "This is a Diaghilon." And Justin Trudeau pointed out, "He's breaking bread with far right extremists, and he won't disavow the endorsement from Alex Jones." And I said there was no real endorsement. Alex Jones just kind of said, "Yeah, I like that guy. Hope he wins."
Yeah. Well, and who cares what Alex Jones says?
And then, yeah, right.
Right? I mean, he's American for one. He doesn't have any play in Canadian politics. He's an American. He's a bit of a crackpot. And yeah, I mean, yeah, he's right about a lot of stuff, but he's wrong about a lot of stuff too. And he's a conspiracy theorist. And like I said, to be fair, he is right about a lot of stuff. But he's crazy
Yeah, he's a
because
nut.
he's a nut bar. And so why would you even acknowledge it?
Exactly, yeah.
Right? I mean, like, it's the best way to disavow someone's endorsement of you is to just ignore it. If you give it power, you're giving Alex Jones power, and maybe that's what Trudeau wants, but yeah, kind of stupid.
Well, and I love the way that he and the lamestream media jumped on this Diaghilom thing, because that was had to come up during the Freedom Convoy, because someone at the Quds border protest had a Diaghilom symbol on a backpack or something like that. And Diaghilom is something that 99% of people have no clue about.
I
And
didn't.
yeah, and I
I didn't know what it was until this morning. I'd never heard of it.
yeah, and all Diaghilom is, and Jeremy McKenzie is the quote unquote head of Diaghilom. It's basically an online fantasy game about this fictitional country that goes from Alaska to Florida, cutting North America in half at an angle. And this fictitional country just happens to be led by a cocaine addicted goat. And it's basically a fantasy game where your president is a coke addicted goat. That's Diaghilom. It's no far right militia force. It's a bunch of idiots who made up a game mocking, well, just making a mockery of life in general, I guess.
It's I imagine it's a bunch of neck beards and incels that play something like this, but because it's like, it sounds an awful lot like what happened with Dungeons and Dragons back in the 80s. If you go and watch the last season of Stranger Things, they show how Dungeons and Dragons was thought to be this Satan worshiping cult. And for those of you who are too young to know, it really was. Like Tony and I grew up in the 80s. We remember that if you said you were a D&D player, people really thought that you were a Satan worshiping cult member. If they found out at school, if a teacher found out or the principal found out that you were playing D&D, they would pull you into the principal's office to have a conversation with you to make sure that you weren't some radicalized, crazy Satan worshiper. And I mean, parents were really, really worried if their kids played it. Like this is what. So, I mean, if you think all these conspiracy theories are a recent thing, they're not. Because, but yeah, back in the 80s, that's how it was treated. Like you said yourself, Tony, before the show, like you and your friends were had to play it in secret, basically. Like I had if I only played it once, I didn't find it very fun. So, but that one time I went, I couldn't tell anybody. I had to keep it quiet. I went to a friend's house and we played it, and I was like, oh, this isn't anything scary. This is just a game.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, we rolled dice and pretended to be other people. That's but see, but I want to drill down more on this whole subject is it's one of those things when once you see it, you can't unsee it. So and now you are our lovely listeners, now that after we talk about this, you'll never unsee it either. And it's how well, on the Vashi Capellas radio show, she always has a little panels for discussion, just like she does on Power Play, and often they're the same people. And the panel she had to discuss this, of course, were Rob Benzies, who was with the Toronto Star. Rob Benzies, by the way, back at the Freedom Convoy, and we brought this up, went to one of the overpasses where people were cheering on the convoy and called them a bunch of, quote, fringe white crazies. Yes, that's Rob Benzies. And Mike LeCouture was on the panel. He hosts that show called The Debate, which I think comes right after Power Play on CTV. And then Marika Walsh, who writes for the Globe and Mail. So I mean, no, hardcore right wingers on that panel. And what they were talking about was how horrible this was for Pierre Poilievre, and what a terrible image this is. And oh, this is the first real hit to Pierre Poilievre, and what a incredible gaffe it was for him. And why did he even stop to get out at that protest when he already has all those and I think one of the guys even said he already has those people, and they were giving him all kinds of advice. They would give it to Pierre Poilievre, that is, you already have those people, so why would you take the risk of getting into a picture with F. Trudeau flags behind you when you need to get people more in the center? Why are you still posing for pictures with those people? And then I realized that I've always known this, but I've never really vocalized that when you see these lamestream media pundits, their discussion is always, how can we help the Liberals win? What can we do to improve the Liberals' fortunes? How do the Liberals come out of this problem? How does Justin Trudeau improve his poll numbers? It's always is how do we make the or get the Liberals to win?
Yeah, it is. And but one of the things that I've always noticed is that their advice to conservative leaders is always to be to is to act more like a liberal.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's always act more like a liberal. Say what a liberal would say, you know, do all of these things. Like if you want liberal voters to vote for you, you got to be a liberal. And it's like, but they're leading in the polls. Like they would be smashing the liberals right now if an election were held today. So why would they act like liberals? Like they're just going to lose support because people are going to go, well, why would I vote for this guy when he's saying and acting and doing the exact same things as that guy who is already in office? It's like the devil I know versus the devil I don't know, you know? But he's saying and doing the same things he's doing. So why would I vote for him when I've already got a guy who's acting and saying those things?
Aaron O'Toole.
Yeah, exactly. Aaron O'Toole. Yeah.
I
And
mean,
so, I mean, Pierre Poilievre's best course of action is to keep doing what he's doing, keep saying what he's saying. And don't change because people are supporting that to the point where he's going to have one of the biggest majorities in Canadian history. And that's like, I looked at the latest polling that came out this morning. I still can't believe the Liberals would have 74 seats if an election were held today.
wow.
Yeah. I don't get it.
That's a lot. Holy.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't get it. I mean, it's not like a threat in the House. I mean, the Conservatives, according to this poll, would have 207 seats or 210 seats or something. And we've seen polls in the recent weeks that have shown it all the way up to 227 seats. But so they would have a very comfortable majority government, but I still can't believe that the Liberals would have 74 seats after everything in the past 8 years.
Yeah, well, and a footnote on that, by the way, because listener Trevor is still pumped up about Pierre getting the biggest majority in history. So we did the numbers, and John Diefenbaker currently holds that title with 79% of the seats in the House of Commons in his big landslide victory back in the late 50s, I believe it was. So if you look at the number of seats that are in the House of Commons today, Pierre Poilievre would have to win 275 seats to be the biggest majority in Canadian history. So I don't see that happening, but I still see a huge majority for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, there's just, of course, there is no way that he's going to get the largest majority in Canadian history. It's just not possible.
I don't think it is, but you're absolutely right on point when you say that he just needs to keep doing what he's doing. And to his credit, he is. He's completely ignoring the advice from the lamestream media because they're there to sabotage him anyway, in my opinion. But yeah, he has continued just to go on talking about the carbon tax, talk about affordability, talk about things that actually mean something to regular Canadians and not just academic talking points.
The trick is that he has to follow up when he's elected, when they are elected as a new government, they have to follow up. Like you can't just go, oh, well, we didn't know the books were going to be this bad when we were elected and yada, yada, yada. We can't do what we said we were going to do because it's a big mess. No, you have to do what you said you're going to do. You have to.
Well, and on that, every time there's an interview about when, because I listen to Vashti Kapelos every day, usually it's her that I pick on. When she interviews Melissa Lansman, for example, or Mr. Halan, sorry, the finance critic, it's always she'll let them talk for a minute or so to talk about their talking points, and then immediately it jumps in like, okay, well, where would you cut? Where's the conservative going to cut? Are you going to cut healthcare? Are you going to cut the dental fund? Are you going to cut the child care? And it's always, where are you going to cut? Where are you going to cut? And they even try, they, as soon as they start to answer, she just jumps in. Are you going to cut this program? Are you going to cut that program? And never actually lets them get a word in. But when she interviews Anita Anand, for example, or Chrystia Freeland, she just lets them talk.
Oh,
Oh.
I'll push back on that. I disagree with you on that. When I watch Chrystia Freeland on there with her, she gets very frustrated with Chrystia Freeland for not answering questions.
Actually,
And
that's a good point. I'll give you that.
she will get in there and she'll say, "You're not answering my question. You're not answering my question." And so I don't agree with that assertion, but I do agree. Like one of the things that they have to, I mean, she's a reporter. Her job is to get an answer. And if she's not getting the answer, she's going to dig for it, right? So, I mean, I don't fault her for that at all. But what I do, but what I want to make clear to people is that a political party is not going to reveal their platform until an election is called. That's just the way it works. It has always worked like that. It has never been any different. And no political party has ever said, "Here's our policy book a year and a half out." Nobody has ever done that, because if they do that, then the governing party can steal the ideas that people find popular. They're going to gauge public interest and go, "Oh, well, this is a good one. That's a good one. Okay, well, let's adopt those." And so they don't do that. They don't release those. Their policies until the election is called. So for reporters, because I have seen some reporters say that, like political pundits or political reporters on Power Play or whatever, when she has guests on to talk about this, the panels, right? And they criticize and they say, "Well, the conservatives are showing nothing. They have no plan." Well, since when? When has a political party ever released their plan before the election is called? When? I mean, just one example would be great.
And I think where I was going on that is this, the hypocrisy that for using Vashti as an example, she would never ask Chrystia Freeland, where are you going to cut? Are you going to cut somewhere to have to balance the budget? And will you cut this? Will you cut that? Instead, she just wants to ask Chrystia Freeland what the plan is, I guess. So.
Well, so I don't think I honestly I don't think that your criticism of Vashi is fair in this context, because I've seen her get really frustrated with many liberal ministers when they're on her show, and she holds their feet to the fire. She will not let them get away with a non-answer. So I disagree. And I mean, I would like to see. I think picking on Vashi is unfair. I mean, unless you listen to her radio show, you would have no idea what her political leanings are.
True.
But the it's it. But there's definitely other, political talk show hosts in this country that are definitely worth picking on, because they don't even try to hide their bias.
Like Rosie Barton, for example.
Yeah, like Rosie Barton. I still remember during the 2015 campaign, or not the 2015, which one was it with Andrew Scheer?
19.
19. In 2019, when she was interviewing Andrew Scheer, and she would ask Andrew Scheer a question and then talk over him to answer the question herself. Like, she would answer the question for him while he was trying to answer the question. And I mean, I remember when she was interviewing Stephen Harper in the 2015 election, and she asked him a question, and then as soon as she was done asking the question, she laughed like, "I got you," kind of thing. And then he gave a really good answer, and she just kind of went stone faced, right? Like, it's there's Rosemary Barton is like the worst political reporter in this country, the worst.
Oh, yeah.
And every time a promotion becomes available at CBC, she gets it. But I do have to push back on your criticism of Vashi. I don't think it's fair.
She actually, Vashi is one of the best. I will give her credit for that. But yeah, I wish she would be a bit harder on liberals. But I do have to say one thing about Vashi. She, excuse me. On her radio show, she said, "I know I'm going to lose a lot of my audience for saying this, but I grew up in Toronto and I'm a Leafs fan." And I was like, "Well, very bold of you to say so. Thank you for outing that in public." So.
Yeah, we'll get to hockey at the end of the show.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I am being a bit hard on Vashi because I listen to her more than anybody else. But honestly, the reason I listen to her more than anybody else is probably because she's the most fair. She's still biased, no question about it. But yeah, I agree. She actually, in my opinion, is one of, if not the most fair political I've seen on, at least on any more of the more popular shows. So
The mainstream stuff,
yeah.
or let me rephrase that, because I think that alternative media is now the mainstream because it has a bigger audience than the
Yeah,
what
then
would I call it? The
legacy media.
legacy media.
Yeah.
Legacy media is what I would call it now, because like their viewing audience on legacy media is smaller than it is for alternative media.
Yeah.
Like I'm sure that our viewing numbers on our show are probably a lot higher than people would think compared to someone like CBC. Like I think it would shock people.
Yeah, I agree. So, well, speaking of shock, I'm sure that the Trudeau government was very shocked when doctors actually started pushing back on, and not just on behalf of small business. You were right to correct me on that when we were talking earlier before the show. But doctors just seem to be the focal point because they've been the loudest, I guess, cohesive group to speak back against the capital gains tax increases because it affects most doctors directly, because most doctors in our country are private medical corporations and they've incorporated themselves specifically as a way to build a retirement income that is now being threatened by these capital gains taxes. And Rexy Valdez was the minister that was sent out by the Liberals to support these capital gains tax increases. And God,
Which minister is she?
she is the Minister for Small Business, so I suppose it's probably
Huh.
somewhat appropriate that she would go out there. But Rexy
So.
Valdez, just so you know, Canada, would be the lady who at that affordability retreat in PEI last summer, and I mocked this heavily, and I still do because I troll her on X, released that Foodie Friday video where she was eating at Lobster on the Wharf, I think it was the restaurant in Charlottetown, and she was showing herself eating lobster rolls. Well, Canadians can't afford to buy bread. And I just thought, well, that's just a little out of touch. So yeah, that's
So,
her.
yeah, okay. So I own a small business and I didn't know who she was. So that just says how good a minister of small business she's been.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, exactly. And well, she isn't representing your interests very well. Let's put it that way, Lewis. She was talking with David Common, who now hosts Power in Politics, which is where Vashi Capellos moved from to go to Power Play. And I actually have to give Mr. Common full credit because he wasn't letting Rexy Valdez off the hook. But you only have so much time to ask the same question over and over again. And Rexy Valdez really showed that she is making a very strong push to show herself as one of the dumbest people in the Trudeau cabinet. And
That's saying a lot.
that is saying a lot. So anytime he would ask her a question, you could actually see the Rolodex flipping behind her eyes as she's looking for the talking point that she was told to utilize. When he would talked about doctors are not pushing back against capital gains, you could see suddenly her eyes would lift up and she'd be like, "Okay, doctor, doctor, wait, wait, I've got this. Yes, we want to fast track the foreign credential program so we can bring more doctors into Canada from other countries. So then David Common said, okay, well, let's go with that. Will you be able to bring enough doctors in to replace doctors in Canada who are wanting to shut down their practices? And how do you replace these doctors? And how do you tell these foreign doctors coming in that this is a good place to practice if these conditions exist for the current doctors? And then she would just repeat the talking point. We want to bring in more foreign doctors and, blah, 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 foreign credentials. So then he would try to move on to a different angle and just say, okay, so how do we talk about, these doctors who are incorporated small businesses, and then try to make it more relevant for her? And then again, you'd see the Rolodex going behind her eyes. Okay, he said small business. Oh, let's talk about how we've increased the earning exemption to 1.25 million from 1 million. And he's like, okay, you're not answering my question here. And he'd go back, and she would just go back to the talking point. And I was like, oh my God, woman.
Well, and the thing that, and I said this before we started recording, I was saying how, I'm tired of this being framed as a doctor's issue or as a small business issue. No, this is an issue for anyone who owns an asset.
Exactly.
And that is not just wealthy people. It's anybody who owns an asset and who might want to sell that asset. Your tax on the capital gains, your tax has gone up, and not by a small margin either, by 33%. I mean, yeah, the doctors are pushing back, and that's great because it's actually bringing it to the forefront because we already have a doctor shortage in this country. And if the doctors are willing to, pack up or close up their practice here in Canada because of this tax increase, which is a huge tax increase, and move their practice to the US, we're going to lose doctors and the doctor shortage here is going to get worse. And quite frankly, if you have the means to do it, I don't blame you for doing it. But this is not just a doctor issue, and it is a wider small business issue, but it is also anybody who owns an asset issue.
Yeah, and we talked about that last week. I mean, if you happen to have a cottage up in Muskoka or in the Okanagan or anywhere for that matter, and you decided you want to sell that cottage, well, you're going to think twice now. It's so yeah, if you've got a stock portfolio that you built up over 30 years, it could easily be worth that kind of money where you're going to get that capital gains hit. So, yeah, this is not just a small business issue, it's not just a doctor issue. You're right.
No, and I mean like if you own an apartment, and that you are using that as your retirement plan, where you're renting it out, you're providing housing for someone, you're renting it out, and once you retire, that was going to be income for you because the mortgage would be paid off and that would be income for you during retirement. Well, that's not acceptable anymore. Because you're not allowed to rent. Like, they're making it so you aren't going to want to rent it out anymore.
Yeah.
But they're also making it so that if you sell it, your tax on it is going to be ridiculous. So they're hitting you at every end possible. And I don't know why they would do that, because they want people to sell rentals so that people who are renting can buy them. But then they hit you with a tax rate on selling it that would makes you not want to sell it. So it's like, what are they trying to accomplish here? I mean, they're causing problems at both ends.
Yeah, and well, speaking of that, there with the digital services or digital tax credit that they've introduced in the budget as well. And keep in mind, the budget has not been voted on yet, and I'm actually going to address that right away. But the digital services tax coming up, one of the founders of Shopify, which is now a huge tech company in Canada, was a friend and supporter of Justin Trudeau on his X account recently, and it was can't remember the first name. Litke was his last name anyway. At any rate, he posted on X that, well, it's quite clear that Canada will leave no stone unturned in search of innovation to deter. And I thought, yeah, that says it all right. You're trying to chase these innovators out.
When we already have, I mean, we went over this a couple of weeks ago. We already have the lowest growth of GDP in the OECD and the G7. We have, the lowest GDP per capita in the OECD and the G7. We already have the lowest, which, lowest GDP per capita is the lowest productivity. So we have the lowest productivity per worker too. Like, workers in Canada just do not produce what they do in other countries. We are in big trouble in this province, in this country. We're in big trouble, and they're just making it more difficult for anybody to succeed. So they're everything they're doing right now is just hurting our standing in the world, period.
And a side note on that, for those of you who have been following the Pierre Poilievre's YouTube series Debt-O-Nation, so Debt-O-Nation, just DebtOnation. So Debt-O-Nation, the second part of that is now out, been out for a couple of weeks. That will shock you when you see some of the numbers he presents in part two of Debt-O-Nation.
Yeah, Tony does have a degree, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, you never know it because I can't spell worth crap when I'm tired. The budget also announced $42 million more dollars for CBC,
No,
by the way. Oh, wasn't
42 million dollars.
it? That's right. Yeah, and here's the problem is the Liberals polling did not show that quote unquote budget bump they were expecting. And this shocked the hell out of me. The being they didn't they still Liberals are tanking with the younger demographics, but they narrowed it down to a cohort, the lowest Liberal supporting cohort in this country, at only 9% of people who would claim they would vote Liberal is anybody who has an address within the city of Edmonton. And I just said, wait, the city
What?
that voted completely NDP provincially just a few months ago, a year ago, is the one city in the country that will absolutely not vote Liberal. I thought, hey, I did not see that coming.
Aren't the only Liberal MPs in Alberta from Edmonton?
One in there, one Calgary.
Oh, there is one in Calgary.
Yeah, George Chahal. He's a Calgary Marlborough, I think, is up in the northeast.
Oh, okay. But, oh, that's
Yeah.
shocking. That's shocking. 'Cause I mean, how many years did Landslide Annie get elected there in Edmonton West?
Oh, she was
I
my
mean,
MP. Oh, man.
she was mine too. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Anne McClellan, for those of you who don't know her nickname, Landslide Annie. And she's got that nickname because she kept winning by the skin of her teeth. By just like almost single digit votes. Like, she would just barely scrape by. It was almost always a recount,
Yeah.
and she won like three elections in a row or something, or four elections in a row, and it was all recounts every time.
Yeah.
And then there was the other Liberal there. I'm trying to remember his name, but he was in Edmonton South.
Yeah, him I don't remember. Oh, David Kilgore.
Yeah, David Kilgour. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Edmonton was always like the only source of Liberal MPs that the federal party had in Alberta. And now, wow, that is shocking.
Yeah, I was completely floored when I read that. And that well, I mean, it makes me happy because maybe that means that Randy Wassenaar will be gone in the next election.
Oh, God, we can only hope.
Yeah, but I just thought, like, wow, 9% in Edmonton. That just completely blows my mind.
Wow. No wonder Randy Bossino is such an angry guy.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. So let's want to wrap this up by saying that all this pushback that's been going on in the capital gains and even on the tech front makes for a really good reason for even some liberals to vote against the budget, which would create a vote of non-confidence, which might turn into a spring election.
Yeah, I knew where you were going with that. It would be June at this point, but
True, yeah.
yeah, it wouldn't be May, so you were wrong.
I'd be wrong. Yeah, I'm always wrong when it comes to those.
And I would have been wrong up until last week when I changed the way I was predicting this. But yeah. Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, I was shocked. I'm still shocked, actually, even just repeating it. So,
Yeah. Well.
okay, so now here was a shock to me, and I shouldn't have been because it was again a CBC show I was listening to, and they were talking about stay-at-home moms. That's the one job in this world that I admire more than anything is a stay-at-home mom. When my kids were born, their mom actually stayed home with them, well, right up until her and I divorced, actually. So the kids were would have been like 6 and 7, and I'm all for it. But this particular podcast was talking about the horrors of these women who were not only daring to stay home with their kids and raise their kids in a more traditional role. They were focusing on a few TikTok influencers, and I don't remember the names, and that's not really important. But these TikTok influencers were just saying like, "Hey, you know what? We are being, quote, trad wives," is what they're calling themselves. And they're just saying, yeah, we've chosen to stay home and raise our kids and take care of the house and whatnot. And these two folks on CBC, the host and the guest, were mocking them heavily because, oh, and look, and you can see she's got this nice flowery dress on so she can look good for her husband when he comes home from work. And they're showing how they're cleaning up after breakfast and getting the kids to school, or in some cases, homeschooling, et cetera. And I just thought, why is this such a bad thing? And then they were saying, you know, women like who are doing this, they are really turning back the clock on feminism. And I thought, well, actually, you pointed out, Lewis, that, well, that's pretty rich. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's wrong with being a mom? Like, it's, leave it to the left to demonize mothers. I mean, they've already demonized they've are well, I mean, they're already promoting men as women. But they're also saying at the same time that men and women are the same and there is no difference. So I don't know how they square these circles. But yeah, I mean, like they're just demonizing women who want to be moms, the best mom they can be, which is commendable since being a mom is raising the next generation is the most important job we have. Making sure that the kids that you brought into this world are, grow up to be good people. Like, to me, that's the most important job we as parents have, not just moms, not just women who are moms, but we as parents, it's the number one job we have is to make sure that these kids grow up to be good people. And so I don't understand what's so bad about this. Like, why is this a bad thing? Like, I think it's a bad thing that we dump our kids off with strangers every morning before we go to work. I think, and I'm saying we as in
Society,
society.
yeah.
I mean, my wife stayed home as long as she could with both of our kids. The only reason she went back to work after 18 months with our second kid is because we had the 2008 crash and I lost my job. And in the field I was in, nobody was hiring during that time. So she had to go back to work. But I stayed home. And I mean, I did some contract work on the side, but I stayed home and I was home with the kids until, I was able to go back to work. But it shouldn't be a bad thing. I mean, like we've talked about on previous shows, you know, we're all too willing to sacrifice our children these days. And whether we're sacrificing them to the LGBT movement, we're sacrificing them to wokeness, we're sacrificing them to, you know, anti-white sentiment, whether we're sacrificing them to pedophiles in our schools or in our communities, where we don't shun these people and get rid of them. We support their businesses, like one in my hometown here. It's just shocking to me how much the left especially is willing to sacrifice our kids. And now they're saying that women shouldn't stay home because the women that came before them worked too hard to get them out of the house. And now they shouldn't be betraying those women by staying in the house.
Well, that was essentially the point that guest made. Yeah.
Yeah. And to me, that is absolutely disgusting.
It is. And there was, I mean, this movement, if you want to call it that, started, I remember even about a decade ago, reading articles at that time saying that there were some women who were, quote unquote, checking out of the workforce and staying home to raise their kids. And as far as I'm concerned, if that's the choice that you've made and you can do it, I'm all for it. And I think that it should be the choice of that family to do it. And it should be of no surprise to anybody, by the way, that the guest on this CBC podcast had no kids. And she,
of course not.
Yeah. So she felt it, and she gleefully was mocking these quote trad wives who were on social media saying, oh yeah, well, they're staying home talking about not working while they're making an income being social media influencers. And I thought, that's your takeaway from this? Like, wow.
Yeah, because every stay-at-home mom is a social media influencer.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. I mean, there are the odd social media influencers, but guess what? There's like maybe six that make any money. You know, like this is not like, and trust us, because we have a show that is listened to nationwide and we don't make any money. So we know how many like followers and viewers you have to have just to make some money. And it's a lot. It's a lot more than we get. So yeah, I'm sorry, but there's just no, this to me, this is all just this just comes down to the destruction of the family. And it's something that the left has been pushing for decades. They've been trying to destroy the family for decades, encouraging, not just defending, but encouraging and promoting abortion, promoting and encouraging divorce, promoting and encouraging the LGBT movement, promoting and encouraging the woke movement, promoting and encouraging the acceptance of sexual deviants and pedophiles. It's just one thing after another. It's the promotion and encouragement of women leaving their kids in daycare and going to work. And it's always from the left. All of these issues, these movements are always from the left, and it's always promoting the destruction of the family.
Well, and discouraging women from having kids, period, is another tactic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of disgusting how you see some of these women, and like one of the ones you were talking about, how gleeful they are that they don't have kids. And they kind of mock people for having kids or having that biological need to have kids. And they mock it, and it's like, you know, people who do that, to me, they're just trying to convince themselves that the decision they made is the right one. They're not trying to convince anyone else. They're trying to convince themselves.
I think that's actually a pretty fair assessment. I do remember, I think when my first wife was pregnant with our first child, talking to a gentleman, and he had just said, "Yeah, he was probably about the age we are now." And I remember him saying that he has friends that didn't have kids, and they are the loneliest people he knows, and that's always stuck with me, to this day. So, all right, so we're going to wrap the show up talking about hockey, but we've got one more topic to get to first, and that was a $15 billion announcement by Honda that they're going to expand their current plant in Alliston, Ontario, just north of Toronto, or maybe it's even build a new one, I can't remember, but they it's going to be an EV plant, and it's going to be a comprehensive EV plant that's going to make the batteries, components, and make the entire vehicles right there in Ontario. And well, you'll be happy to know, Ontario, that there is $5 billion of that money is coming out of, well, your pocket and ours, because it's Ontario and Canadian taxpayers who will be forking over $5 billion. And Doug Ford and Justin Trudeau could not have been happier high-fiving and hugging each other at that announcement.
Yeah, and it's funny because like every article that I saw online about this, all they mentioned was the investment that the car company was making, not what the government was making.
Well, what? I'm stunned.
Yeah. So yeah, no, it's and this is at a time when EV sales the demand is dropping quite a bit to the point where Ford announced that they lost $130,000 US per electric vehicle that they sold.
Yeah, I saw that. I didn't actually believe it when I saw that, so that I dug down more, and there is nowhere that's reporting any different figures. So I just thought, wow, like that's huge.
Because like there just is not the sales. I mean, like Ford has had to drop the price of their F-150 Lightning electric truck by 15 grand, I believe. They have I mean Tesla's sales are tanking. Tesla's stock price is dropping. Elon Musk is even talking about having to lay off 10% of their workforce. And it's all around electric vehicles, not around gas-powered vehicles. It's all around electric vehicles. Like they're just losing money left, right, and center on all these on EV sales.
Yeah, well, you made the point, though, many, many shows ago at any rate, that it's not a big surprise, because anybody who is interested in an electric vehicle pretty much now has one. And so now you've got everybody who thinks that they're cool or thinks that they're practical now has an electric vehicle. So now you've got the rest of the market who is cool to the idea or is still unsure that aren't getting them. So no wonder the sales are dropping.
Yeah, well, or they can't afford them. I
Or
mean,
that, yeah.
electric vehicles are expensive. And I mean, we were giving the federal government was giving an incentive to buy electric vehicles in Canada, but it only applied to vehicles that were under $45,000. Well, there was only one electric vehicle on the market that was under 45 grand, and that was a Nissan Leaf. And the Nissan Leaf only has a 100 kilometer range on it. It's only
Jeez.
really meant to be driven in the city to commute to and from work, and that's it.
Wow.
Like, yeah. So, I mean, that was the only one it applied to. So, it's the EV is not the answer. I mean, we already know that the technology isn't the answer because the grid can't even handle it. We don't have the power generation in this country to handle all these vehicles charging every night. And we don't have any plans to build enough generation to actually do it. I mean, we've talked about places like in Yellowknife where the guy wanted a stage two charger in his at his house for his truck, and he had to pay for the upgrade of the transformer on the street. I mean, there's And if every house on that street gets a stage two, that the transformer he paid for isn't even going to be sufficient anymore. So, I mean, like this has not been well thought out. And it's, I mean, and on top of the fact that if an electric vehicle is in a fender bender, they pretty much write it off because they can't risk having a punctured battery pack that will explode or catch fire. Because if it catches fire, it will also explode.
Yeah.
It's like there was one what is it, the Cybertruck, the Tesla Cybertruck, something happened with one in a car wash where it just shut down. It wouldn't start again. It wouldn't go after being in a car wash because the battery pack got wet. Like this is it's half baked. It's not gonna I've been seeing a lot more hydrogen powered cars that have been receiving a lot of attention lately, that some of the car manufacturers are making some real progress with hydrogen powered cars, and that to me is more believable.
Yeah, well, that's the route that Toyota is going. They've actually don't have a fully electric car in Toyota, because they've said that they have hybrids and they're happy with those, but they just haven't gone full electric, but they are trying to move hydrogen. Yeah. But this is what cracked me up, is it came up in this announcement again when they talked about the Ring of Fire. A lot of people have heard about the Ring of Fire. It's an area in Northern Ontario close to James Bay where we have allegedly most, if not all, of the minerals needed to make a lot of these components for electric vehicles. But here's the part they leave out about the Ring of Fire, is there is no mines there at all right now. And there is not even roads to get in to the Ring of Fire to get to said mines. Well, we know, being Canadian, you're 15 to 20 years out if you want to build a mine. So yet one more problem with this whole plant is, where are you going to get all your minerals from?
I mean, they've already said that the mining operations in Canada will have to increase by tenfold. And I think that that's probably a very conservative estimate.
I agree.
And so the people that are pushing for electric cars will be the same people who will be protesting on the road, on the access roads to these mines, that they don't want people digging big giant holes in the mountains.
Oh my God, I hadn't thought of that. You're right. How dare you blast the Canadian shield to make electric cars?
That we want.
And that we want. And
yeah, exactly. Now, speaking of crazy, because when we were talking about BC earlier, we forgot to mention one thing. Seth Packer of Victoria, BC, was arrested after allegedly committing a home invasion and a carjacking while he was out on bail for an alleged carjacking a day earlier, which he was arrested for while being out on bail for an alleged carjacking committed the day before that.
This is Victoria, by the way, which Lewis has already told you is a synonym for crazy.
Yeah.
So he was arrested for a home
for
invasion
carjacking
while so he was out on bail for a carjacking, which he had been arrested for after being on bail for a carjacking.
That's right. And it was like three days in a row.
Wow. So he's consistent, at least.
Yeah. And so this is what's happening in our country, where they just, I mean, the guy was on bail for a carjacking, arrested for a carjacking, then got out on bail again and immediately committed another carjacking and a home invasion and was arrested for that. Like, when are we going to just say enough is enough and just put this guy in jail and keep him there?
Well, I'm surprised that the mayor of Victoria didn't say, surprised the deputy police chief in Victoria didn't just say, Victoria residents should just leave their car keys close to the front door so that they can be easier to steal your vehicle and then nobody gets hurt. Oh, wait, that was Toronto.
Yeah. All right, now let's talk about some hockey.
Okay, I'm just going to put this out here to pump my own tires. Last week, if you rewind and listen to the show, I said, you know what? The Oilers are probably going to do well, and I bet you it's going to be someone like Zach Hyman who might just catch lightning in a bottle. Well, he just happens to have six goals.
Yeah. Ian, so here's something that's really funny. Yesterday, before Toronto played in their game and they got one goal in the game, I saw this post on X, and it says, goals scored through three games. 17 goals were scored by Colorado and Edmonton. 11 goals by Boston, Carolina, Florida, New York Rangers, and Winnipeg. 10 goals by LA. 7 goals by Nashville, Tampa Bay, Vancouver, and Vegas. 6 goals by New York Islanders, Toronto, and Zach Hyman.
That's funny.
Zach Hyman had just as many goals as Toronto.
Jeez. Wow. I knew that the Oilers were an exciting team to watch. I mean, that they have been for most of the season. And actually, a lot of the sports journalists have been putting their hopes on the Oilers to go all the way. And you had brought up very correctly, if we see the right Oilers team, like the one that won 16 games in a row in the regular season, there's probably no stopping them. And that's what they look like right now. I mean,
yeah. Well, first game, they looked great. A little weak on defense. Second game, defensively, they just weren't there. But the third game, boy, oh boy, did they come out. I mean, there was 110 hits in that game. Defensively, they were playing great hockey. Offensively, they were playing great hockey. Like, the Oilers just looked awesome. Like, if they keep playing like they played in game three, there is just no stopping them.
Yeah, I agree. And, well, sorry to Vachy Capellos and the rest of the Leafs fans out there. I think the Leafs are done. I mean, there's that. So, I mean, big surprise. We all knew it was going to be the first round if, you know, their Stanley Cup is if they make it to the second round. So,
well, see, here's an interesting stat. No Toronto Maple Leafs team has ever won three rounds of hockey, of playoff hockey. Ever.
Really?
Yeah, because the last time they won the cup, you did, or no, sorry, is it four rounds?
Well,
trying to
four,
remember.
Four rounds is the cup, right? So.
Yeah, but back the last time they won the cup, they only needed to win two rounds, I think.
Well, it would have been a 16 league, so
rounds?
You're right. No, 16 league, so it would have been, it would have been two rounds, you're right.
Yeah, so they've only ever won two rounds of hockey. They've never won three rounds of hockey in the playoffs. Not once.
Wow.
Yeah, that's an interesting stat, hey?
That is, yeah.
But I mean, their top three just go silent in the playoffs, and it happens every year.
Yeah, well, and the top three in the Oilers certainly haven't been. So, I mean,
no, and boy, was that game three was a pretty exciting game to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, I like the Jets. As soon as they drew Colorado, I knew they were in trouble, and they've held their own. But yeah, I don't think they're going to be able to contain McKinnon and the entire Colorado offense, for that matter. Like, it's just
no, it's true. I mean, they won the first game, but the last two here, they've just kind of, it has not been even a fair fight.
Yeah, true, true.
But I mean, talk about not a fair fight. I mean, look at Vancouver. Vancouver, and they won game three with 12 shots on net.
Yeah.
Only one, though, they were like two shots away from tying the record for having the fewest shots in a playoff game and winning the game. I mean, the fewest is 10 shots on net. Vancouver had 12. It was actually watching that game. And then watching the Oilers game three, I was like, oh my God, if the Oilers and Vancouver play in the second round right now, if they play like that, if Vancouver plays like they did in game three in the second round, they don't have a shot in hell. I mean, Edmonton, the way it almost looked like Vancouver is, like, in that series looks like they're playing at half speed compared to the Oilers and LA series. I mean, the Oilers in LA series is just, it's ridiculous. Like, if you're listening to this and you normally just watch the Leafs, and you've got to turn on the Oilers game tonight because you have got to see what exciting hockey looks like.
Well, that's actually really well said. Yeah. I mean, right now, they if they can keep playing the way they played the other night on Friday night, I don't think there's any team anywhere that can stop them. And it's great. And just so you know, in case you live in Alberta and think, hey, I should go to an Oilers game. Well, don't, because a nosebleed ticket is like $3,000. And they're selling. So
wow. Yeah, but you can go to the Ice District. They're so they've got this big outside viewing area outside the arena with big screens, and they've got vendors and stuff that you can go there and you can watch the games for free outside the building. And they had 22,000 people in the Ice District on Friday night. Yeah. Yeah.
That is amazing. Holy, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's going to be it's pretty exciting. I mean, I say this with the Oilers, they're not the most consistent team, right? That's the thing. If they continue to play like they played in game three, they're unstoppable. But
correct.
But they are not they're not the most consistent team. They do come out and crap the bed every once in a while.
Yeah, that's true. And you're right. If they happen to crap the bed at the wrong time, that's a problem. But yep, hey, even as a Flames fan, I gotta say, like, I'm gonna have to get behind Edmonton, and I think right away. So
yeah, well, and you know, the other Florida's looking really good too. Like Tampa Bay pulled out the win in their game four, right?
Four. Yeah.
Yeah, they pulled out the win in game four, but yeah, they're done too. I mean, but Florida's looking really strong.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have a dog in the hunt in the East, because the only American team I really pay any attention to is the Islanders, and they're done. I mean, they're playing Carolina, so they probably didn't have a chance in the first place. So
yeah, Washington looks finished too. I don't want to speak too soon, but I think that the Stanley Cup is coming out west this year. I don't know where, but it's coming out west.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. So
yeah.
It's all right, Canada. We're going to wrap it up there on a definite high note, because it's playoff hockey. So there's no such thing as low notes.
Unless you're a Leafs fan.
Lou has just isolated half of our audience. All right, Canada. So thanks for tuning in. And until next week, it is Tony in Saskatchewan.
And Louis out here in BC. Good night.
Good night, Canada.